Pro Bull riding circuit resumed last weekend at a 300-acre ranch north of Oklahoma City, with a travel party of about 140 riders, stock workers, and support staff, all tested for COVID-19 upon entry and exit, and socially distanced for their entire stay. Even the cowboys wore masks. What will it take for sports to come back? We'll explore the what, how, and why of a complicated return with PBR CEO Sean Gleason on this episode of SBJ Unpacks. I'm Bill King, joined now by Sean Gleason, CEO of Professional Bull Riders, the PBR. Sean, across sports, leagues and tours are trying to figure out how to come back safely. And along with that comes the question of when to come back. You came to the conclusion that it would be this past weekend. Now, I want to dive a lot into what that looked like in a moment. But first, how did you know it was time? What to you was the barometer?
Well, we were one of the last sports in North America to conduct an event. We did so in Atlanta, Georgia. After the guidance had come down to limit gatherings to 250 people or fewer, and so we conducted an event in a closed environment with 150 people in the building. And and as we left there, the guidance changed, and we by the time we got home, the guidance was 10, and we just knew it would be a matter of when we had to come back for made-for-television events, not if we were going to have to come back that way. And that's when we started the process.
So what does a safe return look like in your sport? There's an awful lot of pieces to that. Social distancing, you did it. The self-contained, quote-unquote, bubble that everyone envisions and is talking about and trying to figure out, you did it. Testing, you did that. I'm sure there's others that we'll get to as we explore it more, but let's start with where you started. What'd you have to figure out first?
Well, honestly, where we started was we need to be in compliance with all federal, state, and local guidance as to how to avoid spreading coronavirus and contributing to the pandemic problem. That's right. Where we started with that premise. And so then we just started tackling the issues one at a time and learning as much as we could about the safe ways to be in public and around other people. And identified every single point of contact for where we knew our staff and our bull riders had to be in proximity to one another. And we really just started there and then started working back to comply with the guidance, creating functional groups of 10 or fewer. Most of the groups are around 6 or 7 in size, and then put protocols in place to ensure that they were socially distanced at all times, except for those few moments where they have to come together in competition.
That functional group becomes really interesting, right? Does that sort of become the key to this?
In my mind, it is. And I talked to a lot of other leads that are interested in how we did this, and I told them the same thing, that it really comes down to, can you create functional groups, and do you have legitimate facilities and resources to keep them separated within the context of the guidelines? So if you can do those things, create those functional groups not just on paper, real functional group that you know you can separate, and then put the protocols in place that require and demand that they do that.
So we hear a lot about the bubble, right? Whether it's a bubble in Arizona or in complexes around Florida or at Disney or at some complex in Atlanta, or whether it's, you know, putting together a handful of teams in each of 6 cities or whatever it may be. There's a lot of things that leagues are looking at, and they all sort of revolve around this idea of this self-contained bubble. Is that the way to look at it, and how did it work for you?
Yeah, you know, it's that is one of the critical steps too, is knowing that you're going to be able to enforce your rules. And enforcing your rules is limiting contact between anybody that may have been exposed to the virus and those that haven't been exposed. And in order to do that safely, you really do need that bubble. And in the case of our return to competition, we were fortunate that we had access to Lazy V Arena, which is roughly 300 acres of pristine, beautiful horse property and outside of Guthrie, Oklahoma, and we could close the gate and have roughly 2 acres per person to put our plan together, to house them and keeping from coming in contact with one another and the outside world.
So what did that look like? Everything from bringing people in there, deciding who is going to be in there, on down to where you put them once you get there.
That was a 40-day process of 15 hours a day of our team really working on, you know, those logistics. We're fortunate, again, to have a big space in Leahy Arena where we had 490, I believe, full hookup RV sites that we could place RVs in the functional groups and keep them away from one another. So really that was just a logistics mapping problem to kind of decide who was staying where and what the flow was. And then we had facilities on site at Lazy V that allowed us to accomplish some other details of the plan, which is really, you know, we knew every single person that were on the ground, from food prep people to security to the cleaning crew. We had tested everybody, so everybody that was in that environment was tested. And all of the functional groups, we kept them apart. And one of the details that we had to work a lot on was, how do you feed all these people and how do you keep them comfortable and happy during what is essentially a lockdown inside a closed environment? And we worked through all those issues and had a very good plan for that.
Well, we're all used to being locked down right now. That probably didn't hurt.
Yeah, and to be locked down on a beautiful ranch property is not the worst thing that ever happened to anybody,
so. So they come through the gate, they get tested, they get cleared. They're then on the property. Those working groups then stay totally apart from each other, stay 6 feet apart from each other. What does that look like?
Well, our rule was that at all times, even if you were in a functional group, if you were not in the few, very few work environments, getting ready to get on, you know, on your bowl, or working on a particular aspect of the TV production, if you were not in the work environment, then even if you were in your functional group, we maintained 6 feet of distance even within the functional groups. And then we required that everybody maintain 10 feet of distance if you were in contact with somebody that wasn't in your functional group. Everybody had lanyards and wristbands. It was obvious who was in what group. And so everybody could, self-police themselves, which they did. We're all professionals. And that's part of it, too.
Right.
You have to have trust in the people that you're working with, that they want to stay healthy and safe. And everybody to a person in our environment signed a social responsibility pledge that said, yeah, we do. And we're going to comply with the rules, and we're going to do this, and we're going to take it seriously because we understand the gravity of the situation. And so there were a few times that we'd send reminders to a group of bull riders, but for the most part, everybody was 6 feet apart the entire weekend.
There are points of contact that are inevitable, right? What are they beyond the rider and the bull? And did you adapt any of those as you dove in? And because you never have to look at your event this closely, right? It's like, I know when there were discussion around baseball and in fact, in youth baseball, and really, as this was all falling apart, there was an organization that said, okay, we're not going to have handshakes. And it was kind of like, well, this goes well beyond that. When you start really diving in and digging in and thinking about your event, what are those points of contact that were inevitable, and were there some also that you said, well, wait a minute, maybe these aren't as inevitable now that we have to think about getting rid of them?
Yeah, for us, the point of contact for the bull riders and the competitors is really in the bucking chutes.
Right.
As they're getting ready to go, they need somebody to help them pull the rope. They need somebody that will spot them to keep them from being tossed into the steel. And so in that regard, we created functional groups of six. Usually it's kind of a free-for-all on the back of the bucking chutes, and a bull rider can go up whenever they're ready.
Right.
Or want to go up and watch other riders. And we limited that to six. And then in our sport, there's a flank man that is responsible for the bull. And so those flank men will work across the event and multiple riders and take care of their bulls. And in this case, we assigned a flank man to a group of riders. So there was no group that was bigger than seven allowed in that environment at any time. They wore gloves, they wore safety equipment, or masks, obviously, and they and they weren't in an environment in which they were exposed for long durations of time. We cleaned after every single section, so the risk of really transmitting or catching COVID-19 in that environment was very, very slim.
Right.
Because, you know, if you read up on it, it's a difficult proposition to catch it unless you're exposed to droplets or in an environment with somebody for a long period of time in a closed environment. So we had the doors open, the fans on. I mean, we took every precaution we could to really keep that environment as safe and sterile as possible. And, you know, the only other real point of contact for people working in the event was in our sports medicine team, who are all medical professionals,
right,
had the proper equipment. And our bullfighters, who were wearing masks and sanitizing regularly on the dirt. And then in the television production crew, we have a few individuals that have to work in proximity to one another during the event, and we required respirators and more sanitation in those environments than you would in some of the other areas. If you do those things, then you're really mitigating the risk of anybody transmitting coronavirus or exposing somebody to coronavirus.
One of the real visuals that you come away with from this is the mask, right? I mean, seeing your cowboys in those masks. And I think that that's something that sort of may be a bit of a lasting value to this. I wonder whether or not, because again, I think a lot of people in their daily lives are getting used to the idea of whether or not they're going to have to wear a mask somewhere or not wear a mask somewhere and whether they're comfortable with it. What was your conversation internally about whether they would do that, whether it was necessary that they do that, or whether it might just be a positive thing for them to do that?
Really, it was mandated from day one, mm-hmm, that, you know, if that's the guidance, which is guidance in a lot of places, that if you're in public, quote unquote, you need to wear a mask. So we adopted what we would consider to be the most stringent of guidelines for any territory to execute this event. And the reality is that by the time we went on with the events, particularly on Sunday, we knew that everybody had been tested and there were zero cases of COVID-19 as a result of the testing. So we could have significantly reduced those requirements, but we not only wanted everybody to stay very safe, but we also wanted to send a message to the public that these are things that are expected of you if you want to help yourself stay healthy and stop the spread of coronavirus. But we didn't want anybody after looking like a cowboy,
right,
for a better term. you know, they definitely look like a cowboy, but they look more like a bandit with their masks on.
Right.
But we wanted to send a positive message that people should be wearing their masks. They should be sanitizing regularly. And, you know, they should be doing those things that stop the spread of coronavirus. And I think we wanted to deliver a positive message through the broadcast and not that it was safe to just go about your regular, ordinary business.
Let's talk about buy-in, if you would. You know, your riders and your stock providers certainly wanted to get back to work. I'm sure of that. But they also would have the same concerns and same fears as a lot of people do about this virus, not only for themselves, but for their family. What was that conversation? They're certainly motivated, again, financially, to get back to work, but there was a health risk too, right? So how did you work through that with all of them?
Well, to be perfectly candid, the bull riders are all young adults in their 20s.
Right.
And, you know, their concerns about this virus are not the same as someone like myself, as an older adult that may be more susceptible to significant health issues. So with the bull riders, there was zero concern, I can tell you. But we made them fully understand, and they did, that it was important that they do this for the health and safety of those that are at home and others that they may come in contact with once they leave the environment. Everybody else that was there was there of their own accord, voluntarily. I mean, there were no repercussions among our crew if somebody didn't want to work. And frankly, we took people out of the pool that wanted to work that were in hotspots that we saw that this wasn't worth the risk of exposing other people to somebody that may or may not come in contact with mm-hmm. it in a hotspot like New York or LA. So we actually had different TV talent this weekend. We'll get back to our regular talent team because they've since left California and several have left New York to isolate so that they can work.
Mm-hmm.
But I can tell you there wasn't a person there that didn't feel safe and didn't feel safe in that environment. And they were not concerned about their health because once they got there, they realized how strict and stringent the rules were and how much time and effort we had put into keeping them safe in that environment.
Another piece of buy-in in this situation is governmental, right? The municipality. I suppose there are ways to do it without support that goes all the way up to a governor's office, right? I mean, I think that as people have looked, if you think about the UFC, they've looked at doing it on tribal land and be outside the governance necessarily of a state. I suppose there are lots of possibilities you could have looked at, areas where maybe the state wasn't particularly behind it, but a town or a municipality or a city or a county wanted to do it. Those certainly would have been options. You didn't go that route. And you did get actual buy-in all the way to the governor's office, right? Was that important?
It was important to us. To be perfectly honest, we had county approval, and Lazy E is a private property that sits in the county. We had county approval as early as April, I believe, 2nd or 3rd, and we're looking at the possibility of going that early. But we chose to not do that until we had city, state, and county buy-in. We wanted the entire community to understand our plan. We wanted them to be supportive of getting back to work. You know, it was there's a major shift going on right now where I think a lot of people in America are starting to look at how do we get back to work. And we've been working on that for 41 days mm-hmm. straight, you know, 15 hours a day. And we're prepared to get back to work in this way. But there's so much concern in the general population that we didn't want to do it without everybody understanding how much time we'd spend on this plan and how safe and responsible it was. And we finally got that from all three levels of government. And, when I drove out of the Lazy E ranch in my RV for my, 12-hour trek back to Colorado, somebody in the community had come put up a sign that said, God bless PBR, we love you, and somebody from the community. And I almost lost it, to be honest with you. but that's really the sentiment that we wanted to get and not have it be something that people were afraid of.
That 41 days, I expect that had to be a period of fits and starts. I mean, especially when you think about so much that changed over the course of those 41 days. That's one of the hard things about this is that every time you think you have the target, it moves. I wonder what it's like to try and make all these changes then.
It changed every single day, particularly in the beginning, and so I mentioned, we had an event closed to the public in Georgia and left there. And the guidance was 100 and, gatherings of 150 people, 250 people or fewer, generally from federal and every state level. When I got on the plane to fly home from Atlanta, Georgia, when I landed, the governance was 50 people or fewer. So it changed in the 2 hours that I was on the plane. We started, making adjustments to our thinking at that point, still said, okay, we can do this. And then by the time I woke up the next morning, the guidance was limit gatherings to 10 or fewer people. And then you start throwing in stay-at-home orders, and then you start throwing in travel restrictions. And so there was a hit a day that we had to overcome in the plan. But the good news was that we had such a fundamentally solid plan that those were just adjustments and not shutdowns of what we intended to do.
The results, you went in, nobody tested positive, unit came out, nobody tested positive. How have things gone since then? We're talking about several days later in that regard. And obviously, if you're going to go back and you're going to test, you have to start asking, what do we do when somebody tests positive? So walk me through that a little bit, if you would.
Yeah, so we had a protocol in place for positives. And frankly, I thought we had a better chance of getting a positive than all negatives. And we had our testing protocol, and we've worked with Dr. Farber and several other medical professionals to define that process and understand it and where the points of potential spread. And so as part of our testing process, we actually had been tested for both active virus as well as antibodies. And the antibodies test, although not foolproof, can give you an indication that somebody is positive. And so we had isolation trailers on the property that that were specifically for anybody positive. So had somebody tested positive, they would have been isolated to those trailers and or depending on their circumstances and their symptoms and other things, would have been turned around and sent out of the grounds. But we would have also then had an active virus test that we could call on to confirm results and then take further precautions. But nobody that had any sign of active virus was going to be released into the population. And because of the functional groups, if somebody did have it, then we only had to test 5 or 6 other people in their group in order to fully determine whether or not the exposure had spread. So we had a very aggressive policy of isolating either symptomatic people or people who tested positive.
And now, will they be tested again before they return? When they return, how does that look like? Because how does that look? Because you go back, right? Now, when are you back?
Yeah, we're going back on May 9th and 10th. We'll Buck Bulls. Everybody will be there for testing on Thursday prior. And we'll have the test results back on Friday. And we will have everybody isolate and certainly not make contact with anybody outside of the functional group for sure until Friday when we know the tests are released. Even then, we'll still maintain our same protocols. We're actually looking at potentially adding a few people to the back of the bucking chutes because the functional group of 6 made bull riding a little more dangerous. And frankly, our athletes and competitors are at greater risk of getting hurt by a bull riding bulls than they are catching coronavirus.
Right.
So we're making a couple of tweaks to those functional groups that are for safety during bull riding and also still consistent with all the guidance and everything. So we'll have everybody tested again. And then anybody this next trip, a lot of people are just going to stay on the grounds. If anybody does leave that's within 3 or 4 hours drive, they'll be welcome to go home to their families. But they'll be tested again before they come back for the next weekend. So we're going to have a process of testing before any and all activity and where we put people into our bubble.
Testing clearly is a huge piece of this. And I know when the NBA, and it was a different time, but I'm not sure how different, depending on where you live in the country right now. But the NBA, there was certainly some blowback after people started to hear, well, wait, we can't get nurses tested, but you're testing NBA players. Certainly you're doing it with 140 people, not at the same rate of an NBA or an NHL or a Major League Baseball that would be testing, hundreds, really 1,000. But from a public perception standpoint, I'm sure you had to think it through. How did you think that through?
At first, the guidance today still is if you're not symptomatic, you don't need to go in for a test.
Right.
And that is the guidance. And I've seen a lot of blowback and pushback on the NBA, on other leagues that have talked about testing. But as we did our homework and our research, what we realized is there are a lot of tests out there. The shortage of them is really on the states for not ordering them and for not having a plan to get them out there. There are plenty of tests out there, and some are in various stages of FDA approval, and others are there's only a couple that are approved. But there is testing out there that is very reliable that as reliable as any can be, because they're not all 100% foolproof right now. But the, you know, we ultimately made the decision that if we can't afford to buy the tests, and if we can't afford to administer them, and we can do it without taking anything out of the medical supply chain, then we're going to go ahead, and that was ultimately the decision. There's plenty of tests out there if people want to get their hands on them, and so ultimately for us, you know, that's what it came down to. We decided that we should test, and we feel like, you know, getting our industry and our people back to work is as much of a contribution to society as, you know, not testing and sitting way more, actually, way much better contribution to our society and economy is putting money in people's pockets and having them be able to afford to feed their families and feed their bowls and make a living is much more important right now than the possibility of just not testing because of public opinion that is misguided and sitting on your butt doing nothing.
So
I think that's what's frustrating me right now, having gone through all of this, is there's a lot of businesses and industries that could get back to work by putting the time, effort, and energy into a safe and responsible plan to do it. And I feel like it's every American's obligation to start figuring out those things as opposed to sitting around and waiting for this broad governance that is not one size fits all for every place in America.
As you've had conversations with leaders in other leagues and in other properties, what's your advice to them on coming back?
Well, one, I've shared our plan willingly with anybody that's asked, so it's probably gone out to 10 or 12 other sports leagues and organizations. And it really is, you know, my message to them is, get in there, test, create the bubble, get your professionals around you. We have a lot of professionals. It's not me. You know, I've done a lot of homework on this to understand and know where I should lead our organization. But I relied heavily on medical professionals to tell me how to do this and what to do. And, you know, get out there and get those people working on your behalf to understand the circumstances and help you create a safe environment to get back to work. And that goes for every sport and every business in America. And, you know, there's just a lot of people that are sitting around, I think, waiting for somebody to tell them how to fix the problems. And I just don't see that coming. You got to get in. You got to understand this challenge that we're facing. And you got to go out and do the work to understand your particular business and how you can apply the guidance and the safety procedures to get your people back to work.
Well, Sean Gleason, CEO of Pro Bull Riders, thanks so much for helping us to unpack your experience, which is a first and only at this point. I'm sure it's something that you'll be sharing with many. There's still time to join us for part four of the CAA World Congress Comes to You. The final part of World Congress Comes to You will be on Wednesday, May 6th, with a brand new lineup of speakers. Join us May 6th and hear from WNBA Commissioner Kathy Engelbert, Activation Blizzard Esports CEO Pete Vlastelica, Kinetic founder and CEO Michael Rubin, National Basketball Players Association Executive Director Michelle Roberts, and other industry executives and personalities. Register today at worldcongressofsports.com for this interactive series filled with exclusive content and networking. If you register for Part 4, you'll also receive access to all the exclusive content from Parts 1 through 3. The entire series is filled with speakers and Q&A sessions that deliver insights to help your business during these times. Join us May 6th by registering at worldcongressofsports.com.